Again, the very thing to which we're calling attention. One of the things Jesus did when he came was to cut out the middlemen and just open your personal way to God. Just cut out the middlemen. There's always someone who will intrude him or herself between you and God. The Samaritan woman found that in John 4. The Jews, the Israelites found it over and over again. There was always someone that somehow could say either you're in or you're out. Either you're with God or you're not with him. And it can be said so quickly, it just rolls off the tongue. That so quickly we can say, God doesn't like that or God does like that. And here are people with all their complexities, with all the struggles, with all the failures, with all the emptinesses, with all the pain. And someone who may not take time to listen to you gives you the answers for questions you haven't even asked. And sometimes we're so desperate, we're so lonely, and we're so hungry that we're vulnerable. It was that way when Jesus was here. But what a wonderful creature he was to come upon him. And it really didn't seem to matter if somehow you never really had been good at religion. It didn't seem to matter to him. Or if you had been one of the really straight and powerful ones in religion, it didn't seem to turn his head. He was fully as comfortable with Nicodemus as he was with the adulterous woman. Who is this one who would release the music in the religious as well as in the non-religious? Who would release the music in those considered by their culture morally accepted as well as release the music in the heart and soul of the one who would never make any claims for moral rectitude? Who is this person? Who is this one who would say to each of these, cut out the middlemen? God is your Father, and you can speak to him. Who is that? And when he came, he found a religious situation in which the religious had found a way to use their religion in a way that separated them from the world. Do you use your religion in a way that separates you from the world? I said a few moments ago that in Jesus' day, the culture was religion, and there was no culture really without religion, not where Jesus lived. That's not quite true in our world. And so we're not so much endangered by the bear trap of religion. It's those little mouse traps that fasten themselves on our toes and make us walk funny that we have to be concerned about. And sometimes those who are on the other side of this whole issue look and they say, why do those people walk funny? And why do they seem to cringe when certain subjects come up? And why are they only comfortable with their own? Why? Religion. Jesus found all of this. Nothing really is new that we're going to today. The fact is that there are certain seductive thoughts that find their way into the heart and soul of religion that makes it ugly. One of them is exclusivism. And another is literalism. And another is elitism. And another is absolutism. Now, I don't worry about any of you wondering about that, because you know that anything that ends in ism is wrong. That somehow life itself and culture has a way of dropping a great veil again and again and again between us and God. And we somehow don't know what it means when the veil is rent from top to bottom and removed. But almost as soon as it was removed, we immediately began to set about the work of making new veils to keep the world kind of in the dark, to keep them convinced that hope lies only in our interpretations of God. And that's a lot to live with. It's painful to live with. And so when one comes to Christ, here is that curious, unbelievable irony. And that is, to be his disciple, you must deal with the question of religion, because it has a way of intruding itself between you and him, and between you and the Father. And if you're not careful, it will be the life of religion that you have mistaken for the life of freedom in Christ. And so how do we somehow pull that all aside? How do we find our way through that? And how do we hear his voice? And how do we know that he is Lord and not the institutions of religion? How do we somehow find our way back to dusty trails on hard sidewalks? How do we find our way back to that glorious moment in human life when one person without anything in between meets another person with respect and with dignity? How do we find our way back to that moment in which there can be an encounter between two, and one of them doesn't have an agenda sometimes hidden for your life? How can we be open again as he was open? How can we be honest as he was honest? How can we be genuine as he was genuine? How can we drop all these middle things that get between us? And how can we just be with another person? Jesus calls us to freedom. And when he calls us to freedom, it is like a call to the last frontier of human life, which was the first frontier. Because surely the central characteristic of what it means to be a human being is to be free. Everything else fits under that category, and yet it is the one which this weekend we're exploring again that is so difficult. It is so hard to fasten onto and to keep. Jesus calls us to freedom. He calls us to this glorious new frontier. And perhaps there are many ways to describe what freedom is. And so what I'm going to give you is just one of many working definitions that happens to be one that I like and that helps to discipline my own life. The free person is the person who is free to do good for its own sake. Now think about that. We can give lots of theories about freedom. We can give lots of ideas about freedom. We can talk about freedom to choose. We can talk about all of that. But doesn't finally it all come down to one thing, and that is the ability, the freedom to do good for its own sake? There is nothing that speaks more compellingly to my selfish heart than that. There is nothing that speaks more powerfully to my own self-centeredness than that. Because as long as self rules, it's hard to do good for its own sake. You have a bottom line for everything that you do. Your own interest drives everything you do. Or the interests of that are religious, they drive you. Or the interests of your church drives you. And we almost do not know what the experience is like to do good for its own sake. That is the most untried practice in religion today. It is the most untried practice among all humanity today. It is right to do good for its own sake. And striving to live free with that one principle would lead you and guide you into the answer to the question, who speaks for God? And how does one discern the Master's voice? You see, I want to find the answer somewhere else. I will look anywhere for that answer instead of in this place. Because every other answer is a lesser answer. Every other answer demands less of you and me. Every other answer is diminished. This is the great cry. The right, the freedom to do good for its own sake. And to have that experience just once, makes you know what it's like to live on the frontier to which Jesus calls us. There are not many on that frontier. And when you get there, it's war. It's war with yourself. Sometimes it's war across enemy lines. Pierre Teilhard de Chardin, in a wonderful essay entitled Nostalgia for the Front, described his own experiences in World War I. He described walking along those front line trenches, going up the line, as he referred to it, and seeing the sky become yellow with the bursting of shells, and to smell the dirt from the desert, and to hear the cries and the screams of pain and the dying, and to get in those trenches. But he said, one can experience something there that may be unlike any other experience. Because the moment you hit those trenches, you leave behind all social conventions. You leave behind all your routines. You leave behind that envelope of your worries. Worries about family. Worries about money. Worries about relationships. You leave behind the fretting about the business. You leave behind even the fretting about your own self-image. And somehow there is forged there on that front line something that can only be described, in his words, as a new existence. And he said there are many who have had that experience who years later have never found another experience that quite matches that one. And you know, it may be that in all of our work of religion that we have not yet quite tasted the exhilaration of being on the front line, of being on the frontier, and of knowing where the real battle is joined, that battle is not among each other, but that battle is joined with another enemy, with whatever it is that would stifle the music of your heart, and that somehow would imprison the song which you and only you can sing, that somehow, instead of giving you freedom, gives you even greater bondage. Have we ever had that experience? If we're on the frontier, and we've had that experience just once, then no other experience, religious or otherwise, is quite like that. What must every disciple do? We yearn just for one experience, just for one moment, in which I am acting apart from self-interest, in which I am acting apart from selfishness, in which I have no bottom lines, in which I have no hidden agendas, and whose only eye that interests me is the all-seeing eye of a heavenly Father. And it is to that life that Jesus then gives us instruction and prepares us in his matchless message on the Mount. Why is it that he says, don't murder? It is because you can never get to this place, to this frontier, to this exhilaration, to this experience of being alive, if you practice the art of killing the human beings around you, whether with a gun or with words or with looks or with coldness or with resentment or with a lack of forgiveness. And so Jesus says, if you want to be free, then somehow you must put aside a way of life that always is seeking to kill your brother, that is always seeking to wound the one who may, in your eyes, be a little better than you. That somehow we must get past all the competitions and all the rivalries and find another common humanity with one another. His instruction not to murder and not to be angry with another is not meant to inhibit you. It is meant to stimulate you along the way to this frontier where you can be free and where you can sing your songs. That is why he says, you must not bear false witness, but you must let your language be simply yes and no. It is because double talk and hidden agendas will not bring you to the frontier. Again, he is not trying to catch you. He's not trying to trap you. He's trying to set you free. And the great thing about the freedom is that the murderer, literal or otherwise, can still find this freedom. You just can't find it if the way of your life is of a murderer. And you can lie and still find this freedom. It is just that you do not yield to the lordship of lying in your life that keeps you from the frontier. It keeps you from being free. He says, agree with your adversary falsely. Why? Because you can't get on with the business of being a human being. You can't get on with the business of being what you're on this earth to be, of fulfilling your dreams and following your own bliss, if you're burdened and weary with these distresses. You see, the Sermon on the Mount describes a way of liberation. It describes a way of freedom. And if you're going to spend all your time hassling others, if you're going to spend all your time with adversaries, and I know what that is. I've spent a good portion of my life and a good portion of my time just dealing with adversaries. I hope I'm getting better at it now. There are not many arguments worth winning. And one of the best lessons that I ever drew from my mother was, you don't have to win. You only have to love. But somehow, if we would let the peasant, and let him stay a peasant, don't put the robes on him too quickly, and don't adorn him with too much gold, because that is so alienating. It is so separating. Let him be a man with scars and sweat and blood and tears and anguish. That is a God who comes near to your life and who promises to give you freedom, real freedom, freedom from within, freedom to be a person, freedom to be alive, freedom to be on the frontier, freedom to do good for its own sake, freedom to sing your songs, freedom to release your music. When he says, thou shalt not commit adultery, don't even look on a woman to lust after her. He's somehow not trying to stifle those drives of our bodies, but rather he describes a way of dealing with people, a way of doing good. And he says there's a way to deal with the normal drives and longings of your bodies that'll keep you from the frontier, that'll keep you from all of those longings and desires and those words that you've spoken, that you want to be free. It'll keep you from that. When he says, love your enemies, oh, there's a difficult one. That you may be the sons of your Father. Again, he is describing a path. He's describing a road to freedom. Or, put another way, he is somehow showing us how to be free from life's trivialities so that we can get on with the business of living itself. These things are all trivialities. They're burdensome trivialities. Chardin, in that same essay, Nostalgia for the Front, said he was going across a peasant's field, a farmer's field, a plow field, getting on his way back to that front line, to those trenches. And he was intersected by the peasant who was tilling the land, who accosted him, and who chewed him out royally for crossing his plowed field. Am I so blind and so deaf and so distracted and so trivialized that I have even used the common labors of my hands to keep me from the frontier of freedom? Life on the frontier, the Lord's Prayer. It's a liberating prayer. I make it the core of all of my prayer life. And for years, day after day, maybe never missing a one, that's the core of my conversation with Him. And I've learned more about that prayer this week than I ever dreamed. It's all somehow there. The point is, there is so much in this whole question of religion. There are so many institutions. There are so many traditions. There are so many middle persons. There are so many veils. There are so many words. There are so many people who dare to speak for God. There are so many voices who claim to be masters. What does a person do? What does one in the world do? What does a lonely person do? Depressed, what do we do? How do we sort through all of that? Do we somehow in our desperation simply give in and identify with something, anything, to drive away my loneliness? Or will I take a different road? And just look at Him. You say, where are you going with this? Well, I'm about there. I don't have any secret arrows in my quiver. I'm just telling you that one person with relationship with Him is enough against any of life's complexities. When that one person is surrounded or filled with a group that somehow strives for the same thing, I think that the church, if the truth were known, is the last great nurturer of freedom. If it doesn't nurture freedom, the freedom about which we're speaking, then pray tell me, what will? And so the place to begin in this great quest is not to survey and go shopping in the supermarkets of religion. It begins at a different place with things like, look not to your own interests, but also to the interests of others. It begins by remembering that wonderful counsel in the Old Testament which warned against plowing the corners of the fields. If you would just leave the corners of the field of your life for others. That was the problem, one of the problems of the rich man that Jesus talked about, who was pulling down barns and building greater barns. He didn't even leave the corners for others. And it doesn't make any difference how many religious words I'm using. If I've missed this simplicity, a simplicity heralded by all the prophets, a simplicity focused on in the person and life of Jesus Christ, a simplicity which reaches all the way to us in this day. And I think sometimes as Jesus bade the disciples leave their nets, that doesn't necessarily even mean leaving your job, but it means finding this freedom where you are. It's not easy, but it's doable. And we do it little by little. And I like that story out of India, in which there was a bird that was singing on the very top branch. And as that bird sat, he was able to see the vast vistas and those long horizons. And he felt that swelling sense of freedom and joy and celebration. And there was another bird several branches below who was just eating the berries. And he would just sit all day long, oblivious to the horizon, oblivious to the frontiers, and he would just eat the berries. And then once in a while, he would get hold of a very bitter berry. And when he did, he would leap up to the limb just higher. And he would begin again methodically just eating the berries. Until again he would get one that was very bitter, and then he would leap up to the one just higher, and the process continued until one day he was sitting right beside the bird at the top, surveying the vistas. Some of us eat the berries of life, but we leap up limb by limb. And we've mistaken the berries for the horizon many times, for the frontier. And yet there's something about us, because of the song that is in us, because of the music that yearns to be addressed, we keep at it, and we keep getting higher and higher, until one day you'll find yourself right on that top limb. I hope to find myself there one day when I can survey those great frontiers. What about world conquest? What about all the souls of all the men and women and children across this world? How do we deal with that? And since I'm at the end, I'll only say, it might be that with all of our clawing and all of our talking, we might not have discovered yet the way to do that. Let us be of humble frame, of humble mind and heart. Let us be meek and contrite again, not believing that we have that answer and that process all fixed. There's another way to live. There's another aspect in which we can live our lives, in which we can experience on a day-by-day basis great joy. And when our efforts to win others will not be some job of saving souls, but will be the simple manifestation of our spirits. And that gets us back to the leaven. I want to be leaven for my God, not a military phalanx. I don't want to move across this scorched and bitter earth doing more harm. But in the oath of Hippocrates, let us take the oath tonight to try with our religion just to do no harm. Because still there is lifted up that one who stretched arms from the east to the west, and whose heart was able to engulf all the people of his day, and that has reached down through these years and has touched my heart and made me new and made me different, and has given me a sense of aliveness, and has given me a song, and has given me music. He has reached across all of those years, and in spite of all the religion, some of it very, very bad, with which I was inoculated. So I went through a period of my life in which I was so inoculated against religion that I couldn't experience it. And yet somehow, above all of that, this day, I too, Jim, heard him say, "Come unto me, all you who labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest." Take my yoke, not the yoke of religion, but take my yoke, doing good for its own sake, dreaming the Father's dreams after him. Take my yoke upon you. My yoke is easy, and my burden is light. And I believe that in God's great time, he will magnify his name, and that our work is simply to be his instruments and to wait for his day. May his peace go with you.
Let's sing number 10 together.
Deeper than the ocean and wide.